This is the fourth day of this January 2012 Rosh Chodesh Sheshin. We'll resume reading from the teachings of the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei. And this is from a book called Bankei Zen, translated by Peter Haskell. We're reading from the first half of the book, which is a collection of his relatively brief Dharma talks. And this one, he's talking about illness. So it starts off here, I'm a little confused. There's a quotation mark at the beginning, but I don't find the end of the quotation mark. So I'll just jump in here. With my only thought to find the Buddha mind, I struggled fruitlessly, floundering desperately and dashing all over. But what happened was that I got myself ill and was laid up in bed for a long time, so that I've come to know a lot about sickness too. Being born into this world and having a body, we must expect to meet with illness. But when you conclusively realize the unborn Buddha mind, you don't distress yourself over the sufferings of illness. You clearly distinguish illness, suffering as suffering. This is because the Buddha mind, being originally unborn, has nothing to do with joy or suffering. The reason being that that which is unborn transcends thought. It's when thoughts arise that you experience suffering and joy. Let's just pause there for a minute. So this is a very important distinction he's drawing between illness or pain on the one hand, and then what we add to illness or pain with our thinking about it, which is suffering. Sometimes in Buddhism, it's called the second one that we incur unnecessarily. We call this suffering on top of suffering. But I think it's good to distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain, as he says, is what is our lot. Anyone who was at Bodhidharma who said anyone born with a body is an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. Now, here, I think by suffering could have been translated as pain, that it just comes with having a body-mind complex. We're going to be in pain sometimes. If not physical pain, then emotional pain. It's how we respond to that pain that determines whether we truly suffer. That's where the Dharma steps in. We have a choice. Let's take it down to the most obvious in this context, physical pain. We have pain in our legs when we're sitting. We have a choice to sit and dwell on it, to think about it, to strategize, even though we know we've tried everything in way of different kinds of cushions and everything, but to continue strategizing, weaving more thoughts about the pain, thinking about making it into a my pain, and then maybe some self-pity, stir a little of that in, why should I have to do this, or then let's throw in karma. Oh, what a heavy karma I must have to go through all this pain. And on and on and on. Everyone can bring something to this this evil brew of thoughts. But without the thoughts, when we're just thoroughly one with the pain And how do we become thoroughly one with the pain? Well, we become one with the practice, of course. There is no, when we're completely, fully present and free of thoughts, then the pain and the practice just melt together, and all we have to do is lose ourselves in the practice, and then there's no longer any pain outside us. That's the secret of working with physical pain, is to unite with it via the practice, via the breath or the koan or whatever our practice is. When we become so merged with our practice, pain practice, then it's not that we make it disappear, although it can actually, can suddenly vanish, physical pain, but that our relationship to the pain changes. That's the key thing. Our relationship to it changes. Now it's no longer something outside us that can menace us or oppress us, but it's just the pure experience of the pain, and that means that it usually will recede. The pain will diminish. It may not go away, but it doesn't need to go away. If it recedes or diminishes, if it becomes something out in the margin of our awareness, this is a hard lesson to learn. It's harder for some people than others, because we're so conditioned when we're facing pain to either fight or flee. Either we're conditioned primarily to steel ourselves against the pain and try to white knuckle it, which is a mistake, or to try to flee it in some kind of mental gymnastics of trying to distract ourselves somehow with fantasies or things. Each of these strategies, these ill-conceived strategies of either fighting it or fleeing it, each may work for a while. But it's no ultimate solution to the pain. And it doesn't work very well in our daily lives, steeling ourselves against pain or fleeing it. That's not an intelligent way to work with the pain of life. Never mind now just the physical pain of sitting, but the pain of losing people close to us, the pain of having someone break up with us in a relationship or suffering a divorce or anything like that. So the ultimate way to transcend pain is to become one with it. He goes on, the Buddha mind doesn't attach to illness. It remains in the unborn just as it is, so it doesn't create suffering. If thoughts did arise from the place of the unborn, there would be no way you could help creating suffering, attaching to your illness and changing the Buddha mind. But that's hardly the case. Even the successive sufferings of beings in hell, so far as the suffering itself is concerned, aren't any different. Once we turn this corner in our relationship to pain, we have just learned something that will immensely simplify our lives, because we without even having to think about it, we have incorporated, that is, we have gotten into the body this wisdom of oneness. And so if we do lose someone close to us, without having to think it through, we know not to separate ourselves from it, but to fully be the grief. Or being laid off, becoming unemployed, or of not trying to, you know, one strategy is to try to talk yourself into use a positive kind of cheer yourself up and all. And that too, it's not that it doesn't work, but a much more profound way of coming to terms with the basic pain of sentient existence is to unite with it. Be the pain. He goes on. Caught up in the suffering of attaching to your illness, you start thinking one thing and another. I ought to be well by now. Maybe the medicine's not right. Maybe the doctor's no good, and so on. Clinging to the hope of recovery, you switch the Buddha mind for anguished thoughts so that the illness besetting your mind becomes worse than the original sickness. It's as if you're chasing after something that's running away. Even as you gradually do recover your physical health, the mental sickness of chasing after it is gaining the upper hand. That's what's meant by attaching to things and making yourself suffer. I can't help but read this paragraph in terms of other kinds of mental suffering that people go through in Sesshin. Let's reread it. Think about frustration or impatience with your practice in the Zendo. I ought to be well by now. Maybe the medicine's not right. Perhaps the doctor's no good. He may not be any good, but and until you have another one, then you just have to become one with the conditions. That's really the bigger issue here is becoming one with conditions, the conditions of our life, beyond pain or sickness. It's becoming one with the conditions. This is half of Zen practice. Half of the secret to peace of mind. That's what's meant by attaching to things and making yourself suffer. All the same, if there's anyone who tells you he can undergo not only illness, but every kind of suffering without feeling any pain, that fellow is a liar who still hasn't realized the marvelously illuminating dynamic function of the Buddha mind. If there's anyone who tells you he feels absolutely no pain at all, I doubt he knows the difference between feeling pain and not feeling it. There's simply no such thing as not feeling pain. Let me just pause for emphasis there. This is a not such an uncommon mistake that some newcomers may have, thinking that okay, that they see Zen practice as a way to escape pain in life, and they may think that someone very seasoned in Zen practice never has pain. But again, it's a condition of being a human being, or any sentient being, is pain sometimes. There's simply no such thing as not feeling pain. And not just physical pain, but emotional pain. Since the Buddha mind is endowed with a marvelously illuminating dynamic function, not only illness, but everything there is can be clearly recognized and distinguished. That's why when you're faced with the sufferings of illness, if you simply don't get involved with them or attached to them, there's nothing you won't be able to endure. When he says don't get involved with them, he means thoughts about it. There's nothing you won't be able to endure. So just go with the illness. And if you're in pain, go ahead and groan. But whether you're sick or not, always abide in the unborn Buddha mind. Remember, just to repeat, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind means abiding in no thought, being fully present. Abiding in the unborn Buddha mind means non-abiding. Another talk. When it comes to the idea of being free in birth and death, people are apt to misunderstand. There are some who, beforehand, announce they're going to die in a certain number of days, while others go so far as to express their intention to die, say, next year, in such and such a month, and on such and such a day. When the time arrives, some of them, even though they're not ill, die just as they said, while others put it off for another day or a month and then pass away. These are cases that I don't disbelieve that there have been people who have this kind of power to predict even to the day when they're going to die. And the way Bankei is citing these cases, it sounds like he's starting from that position of, maybe there are such people. But then he goes on, there are lots of people who consider this being free in birth and death. Not that I say this isn't so. So far as freedom goes, they're terribly free. But things of this sort are only a result of the strength of people's ascetic practices, and often they haven't opened the eye of the way. Even among ordinary people, you frequently find this. While they may know the time of their death, they haven't yet opened the eye of the way, and that's why I don't accept this kind of thing. The person of the unborn transcends birth and death. So you see the distinction he's making here between these kind of powers and true transcendence. Zen practice can be used, it can indeed be used to develop mental powers and paranormal and psychic powers, but it's really not something that anyone who as the mind that seeks the way is interested in cultivating. It's just kind of a sideshow. After long years of practice, one can find little psychic powers to one degree or another. Who cares? He goes on, now I'm sure you're all wondering just what it means to transcend birth and death. That which is unborn is imperishable, and since what doesn't perish doesn't die, it transcends birth and death. So what I call one who's free in birth and death is one who dies unconcerned with birth and death. What's more, the matter of birth and death is something that's with us all day long. It doesn't mean only once in a lifetime when we confront the moment of death itself. One who's free in birth and death is one who always remains unconcerned with birth and death, knowing that so long as we're allowed to live, we live. And when the time comes to die, even if death comes right now, we just die, realizing that when we die isn't of great importance. This is a wonderful point he's making. Such a person is also one who has conclusively realized the marvelously illuminating unborn Buddha mind. Talking and thinking about something like what hour of what day you're going to die is really narrow-minded, don't you think? So to repeat here, the matter of birth and death is something that's with us all day long. Well, anyone can appreciate this on a medical, a biological level, that we have probably zillions of cells at any given moment that are dying and being replaced by others. So, of course, medically, it's with us all day long. But it's not just physical or biological. It's other kinds. It's mental dying. And by that, by dying, I mean having no choice but to let go. Or it's another way to understand this daily kinds of deaths we can experience is loss of control. I think many thoughtful people reflect on how they will die when the time comes. I certainly have. And you don't have to just guess or speculate. You just need to look and notice how you're dying in these other ways. So, what does dying mean? It means a loss or a relinquishment of the self. And one form that takes is being criticized by someone. And so just, you want to know how you're going to die when you're 80 or 90, hopefully, and or 100, just watch how you respond when you're criticized. There it is. Do you tense up? Do you lash back at the person? Do you defend yourself? Or to what extent do you defend yourself? This gives us a little preview of how we're going to respond as we're dying. A loss of any kind, loss of a job, this is so common these days. Watch your response to losing a job, or even more of going for a long period unemployed. Watch what you go through, the discouragement, perhaps. Facing any kind of adversity, adverse conditions, where you can't change them, you just have to go with them. Not getting what you want. Watch how you respond when you don't get what you want. The Buddha, in one of the texts, the Buddha articulates four kinds of suffering. Dukkha. Not getting what you want. Getting what you don't want. Being separated from those you want to be with. And having to be with those you don't want to be with. Those four cover a lot of ground. So each of those four, if you're confronted with them, just notice to what degree you're able to just let go. Go with it. Go with the loss. Go with the feeling of isolation or whatever. And or not. In other words, to what degree we cling to the way we our desires, our aversions. The truth is that none of us knows how smoothly, peacefully we're going to die. But we know this, that every hour that we're doing Zazen, we're learning how to let go. And the longer we practice, the more this just becomes our natural way of dealing with loss and adversity. And we discover that it's the only intelligent way to deal with loss and adversity. Something you can't change, you can either fight it and make yourself miserable, or you just have to just open yourself to it and go with it. We're back now to pain, how to deal with physical pain or emotional pain. Open to it. Become one with it. This is the bonus about Zen practice is most people undertake Zen practice in order to learn how to live better, how to live with more grace and peace of mind. But in doing so, what do we find? That we're learning how to die with grace and peace of mind. Because living and dying are not fundamentally different. Here's another good distinction he draws. The reason people misunderstand the difference between thoughts and delusions is that everyone imagines thoughts all exist at the bottom and arise from there, but originally there's no actual substance at the, quote, bottom from which thoughts arise. Instead, you retain the things you see and hear, and from time to time, in response to circumstances, the impressions created by these experiences are reflected back to you in precise detail. So when they're reflected, just let them be and refrain from attaching to them. Even if evil thoughts come up, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them, and they can't help but stop. Isn't this just the same as if they didn't arise? That way, there won't be any evil thoughts for you to drive out forcefully, or any remorse about having had them. It's interesting. I have no idea how widespread this image is of thoughts arising from existing at the bottom of whatever, the thoughts existing at the bottom and arising from there. But it's not hard to believe that it's a widespread image in people's minds, and the sense of thoughts bubbling up from the depths of the mind. But like all images, it's not something we want to buy into and become attached to. Because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, mental impressions from the past are reflected, and you make the mistake of labeling as delusions things that aren't delusions at all. Delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. This is a very useful distinction, which I've never read, at least in those terms before. Delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. So he's making the point that if we can refrain from getting involved in our thoughts, then we won't have to deal with delusions. He goes on, what foolishness it is to create the anguish of delusion by changing the precious Buddha mind, pondering over this and that, mulling over things of no worth. If there were anyone who actually succeeded at something by pondering it all the way through, it might be all right to do things that way. But I've never heard of anyone who, in the end, was able to accomplish anything like this. So pondering over things is useless, isn't it? It's utterly useless. Well, he makes it sound so absolute. There, of course, even in Zen practice, there's a time for considering a problem, reflecting on it, sitting with it. Really, is a good way to come to terms with a really some kind of dilemma. But by pondering, he means thinking about. That's how I take it, thinking about. And we are so limited in what we can accomplish by thinking. It's such a superficial function of the mind, relatively speaking. It has its place, it has its function, but certainly in the realm of spiritual problems, it is useless. So I could imagine maybe someone saying, what do you mean? Aren't we pondering a koan? We're working on a koan. Isn't that pondering? No, it's not. Koans cannot be figured out. No one's ever figured out mu or any other koan. What we do through our sitting is find a way to get underneath the level of thought and pondering and figuring. It's that persistent getting underneath to a deeper level of the mind. This is where insight comes from. Even to use the word underneath is itself an image that has limited validity to it. Who says there's an upper and a lower? It's beyond, may be a better word. We with the koan, we're trying to get beyond the words. Here's another one. I tell my students and those of you coming regularly here to the temple, be stupid. Because you've got the dynamic function of the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind, even if you get rid of discriminative understanding, you won't be foolish. So all of you, from here on, be stupid. Even if you're stupid, when you're hungry, you'll ask for something to eat. When you're thirsty, you'll ask for some tea. When it gets warm, you'll put on thin, light clothes, and when it's cold, you put on more clothes. As far as the activities of today are concerned, you're not lacking a thing. Of course, here he's talking about just our natural intelligence that is beyond IQ. Intelligence with a capital I, the kind of intelligence that animals share. It's responding to things as they are, knowing what's called for. What gets in the way of that kind of intelligent responsiveness? Thoughts. Getting snarled up in our notions of what is right, what's wrong, what's better, what's worse. What gets us snarled up is thoughts of self, the I and the my. So what Bhanke is really urging us to do here is let go of these thoughts, get beyond all of these thoughts, and then this unborn mind, this natural intelligence can function beautifully. And now he contrasts that with people who are very, let's say, have very sophisticated kinds of mental functioning. With people who are clever, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. To have transcended those clever people whom all the world holds in great esteem is what's meant by stupidity. There's really nothing wrong with being a blockhead. Sounds like he's one who should know. If we're to take him at his word, where he keeps admitting that he's a stubborn blockhead. When people say that someone is a clever fellow, let's say, here in this country, we don't so much use the word clever as highly intelligent, brilliant. I ask to meet him, and when I do, and we have a chance to talk, it looks to me as if people in the world are praising an awful lot of foolishness. The fact is that those clever people acclaimed by the world are, from the start, deluded by their own cleverness. I think of, maybe it's the season, but I think of politicians who are so, so clever with words. They distort the Buddha mind and obscure its marvelously illuminating dynamic function, considering other people as of no account, contradicting whatever they say, slighting and insulting them. Of course, since those they're insulting are also amply endowed with the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind, they aren't going to let themselves be slighted like that, so they get angry and answer right back, heedlessly pouring forth abuse. Again, the candidates in the primary now. The true person's ideal is to show kindness to those who are foolish and help those who are evil. To be recognized as a good man by the people of the world is precisely what makes being born a human being worthwhile. How can it be any good to earn yourself the reputation of a wicked person? I think also of Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Of course, what Bhanke here is referring to is the kind of purity of mind. And with that purity of mind, the openness, the childlike openness and and wonder that comes from not complicating things with our incessant thinking about what we don't really need to be thinking about. All of which goes back largely to what we read from yesterday, the day before, this self-centeredness, or that other translation, self-partiality. When we're principally concerned about our own advantages, then we can misuse this marvelous human endowment called the intellect and take advantage of other people and in the end just bring on more suffering. So when you go back to your homes and meet your old acquaintances, you should have them wondering about you all. How did Bankei teach them Buddhism anyway? Why, they've come back even more stupid than before they left. And then he says, what I'm talking about isn't the stupidity of stupidity and understanding. That which transcends stupidity and understanding is what I mean by stupidity. Clearly, Bankei would have been someone with a subtle mind and a great ability to skillfully communicate, to help people change. So, it feels so silly to even say this. I think everyone here probably understands, but after giving a talk like this, that's happened too many times in the past where someone will come and say, well, what do you mean? You mean I should quit my job and just become a shepherd? No. We all know what this means. It means not getting caught in our mental machinations and unnecessarily going through life with our mind cluttered with all kinds of extraneous stuff and gathering wool and I have some famous words here from the great Taoist Lao Tzu. Everyone says that my way of life is the way of a simpleton. Being largely the way of a simpleton is what makes it worthwhile. If it were not the way of a simpleton, it would long ago have been worthless. These possessions of a simpleton being the three I choose and cherish: to care, to be fair, to be humble. These values that Bankei and Lao Tzu are espousing, this isn't just gooey, new age, romanticized foolishness. This is what it all comes down to. Whether you know it or not, this is what the Sesshin process is. We're having the mind cleansed. We're having it purified of extraneous stuff. And that is a process of simplifying our minds, simplifying our hearts. This is the secret to happiness. Thoreau said it, simplify, simplify, simplify. And all our simplifying must begin with the mind. Lao Tzu continues, when one cares, he is unafraid. When he is fair, he leaves enough for others. When he is humble, he can grow. Whereas, if, like people of today, He'd be bold without caring, self-indulgent without sharing, self-important without shame. He is dead. The invincible shield of caring is a weapon from the sky against being dead. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.